We have two presentations left. And so I've kind of tried to have a flow for the day. We talked before the break about hearing the day-to-day sustainability thinking approaches. We heard from Cabby some of the tools available to help think through how do we make sustainable decisions. What is the sort of limit on groundwater sustainability, that high-level limit? And so now we're kind of putting a bunch of this together as we think about, you know, what is sustainability? What is our vision in the future? And I think that takes a lot of mind power and it takes a lot of analytical power because you're trying to connect community and personal visions of sustainability with the data that you may or may not have available, your understanding of the uncertainty and how much you can trust that data, which is a whole additional analysis that you're doing as you think through this. You're thinking about your business management. What are the staff resources? What's the time? What's the money that I have to put onto these different types of approaches? Balancing all that. And at the same time, as you're thinking about all of that, you have a feeling about it. I heard a lot of laughing and talking today about some of the topics. You know, we have a reaction. These are our emotions. This is what we do with our days. So how do you mix in your feelings into all of that too? And I've been in enough meetings talking about this topic to know that that's a really important part of this. What is it you want? What does your neighbor want? How do you blend those together? So it's that type of discussion that I know has informed a lot of the work that's been done by our previous speakers, and definitely it's informing the work done by the presentations we're going to hear next. So I hope you really are open to what they have to say, and I know we're going to get some good questions afterwards. So with that, I will stop talking and invite Steve Thompson from the DNR to share some of the work that he's been doing to try to tackle this. Thank you.
Thanks, Lanya. I appreciate it. This is a great conference, great crowd. And it was maybe a month ago or more that Lanya asked me to give a talk, and she suggested a title. And then, of course, without thinking very much, I just said yes. But it's a good title for what's going on, I think, in the state and at the DNR. We do a lot of work measuring all sorts of attributes of water amounts of water and water quality in the state. We also are working as a larger team at the DNR and our sister agencies and all of the consultants and all of the local groups to move us towards sustainability. So I think this what we're going to talk about today is what is the DNR doing in relationship to sustainability and what are our plans for the future. But first, a book review. A few weeks ago, Ruth McDonald asked that I do a book review of this book that I had mentioned at one point for the MGWA newsletter. First of all, I want to say I don't recommend this book. But I'll tell you why I think it has an interesting kind of a story to it. It's, you could read it, I guess, if you wanted to. It's kind of an adolescent book, kind of on the genre of Hunger Games. It uses, instead of the Hunger Games, the crisis situation. The situation is a dystopian future world where our water quality has been degraded, people are living in desperate. In fact, the United States is broken into small enclaves because of the lack of water. And the last part of the book, there's chase scenes, and so I kind of skimmed over that part. But the first part is kind of interesting because the setting is in Iowa, and they're families living in desperation, and they're told in school, you have to, give it up for the state. But there's this one place not too far away that is really dangerous. There's bad people that they will shoot you if you go there. And through a series of mishaps, they went through this border of this place. And it turns out that, the people who were guarding the borders, and by the way, the border of that place was Minnesota. And so the people who are guarding their water supplies are the groundwater professionals. So it turns out that they weren't so bad people, but it's all of us. So I think, I think that, in some ways that gives a note to that Minnesota has on its mind sustainability. And I think as we talk about our regulations, our rules, the support we get from our administration and the legislature, I think we have something really special here. So I think let's give ourselves, all of you, a round of applause. All right, managing water sustainability in Minnesota. There's lots of ways to think about sustainability. I'm going to put it into kind of simplistic roles so we can identify what the roles are. In a very broad sense, we can break it into water quality and water quantity. And you've seen this slide before. We have a distributed nature of the way we divide up the responsibilities for the different parts of sustainability in Minnesota. Water quantity is primarily the responsibility of the DNR. That's over on the right side of the screen. And water quality has the responsibility of various different agencies. The MPCA deals with chemicals and industrial pollutants, non-ag chemicals, whereas ag, MDA, in the green, is pesticides and fertilizers. MDH deals with public water supplies and well codes, and Bowser is local water management and planning and conservation. So together we work as a team, and I think there's some of us that have been a part of interagency councils on groundwater issues. So I think the collaboration and integration with both data that we're gathering, our monitoring systems, and having joint initiatives, I think it really speaks to Minnesota. And I know we've heard it, that's not the case in all other states. So I think that speaks to the well of what we're doing in terms of organizing for sustainability. So we're going to focus the rest of this talk, or my talk, on the DNR's role. And so you can ask a reasonable question is, do we have some quantity issues? Do we have volumes of water which are cause sustainability concerns in Minnesota? And the short answer is a qualified yes. We don't have concerns in all parts of the state, but depending on the situation, there may be some potential reasons for concern. At times we have conflicts between users. Say if you have two irrigators and they're competing, and if they're drawing levels down, one may be competing with another, and you could have a lack of water for those purposes. You can have conflict and sometimes if you have a domestic user, and we're going to be talk a little bit about priorities of use, so that we have a system of working out if there is competition between users, who should have right to that water and what should be done about it. We can have non-sustainable withdrawals from aquifers. If we're drawing aquifers down below levels which are sustainable for long-term, that is considered to be unacceptable, and we have that in some situations, but it's not really so common. Probably more common is next on the list is adverse ecological impacts. You know, there's certainly a relationship between quality and quantity, and if you reduce water levels in streams or lakes or basins beyond a level which is ecologically acceptable, which we have to define, that would be a problem. And that can be caused by overuse of water or overpumping. And in some parts of the state, there are natural limits to aqua availability, particularly in the southwestern part of the state. There just aren't in aquifers that are naturally occurring that are available to supply water for the communities in the vicinity or other uses. So the basis of sustainability, and particularly on the quantity part, is we look to state law. And that is the basis of the reason we have authority to work and the basis of how we make our decisions. And it was mentioned this morning the difference between riparian law or common water law that we have in Minnesota and Western law. And you know, for those of us that care about sustainability, we feel really fortunate that we live in a riparian law state, because that means that an individual can't take all the water if they happen to own those water rights and, you know, not care about neighbors, not care about sustainability. It is our job, or since we share the right of water in Minnesota, we all have a right to that water, and no one can take that water away from us. So whether surface water or groundwater, that's very significant. And we have the, with that, then the state has accorded the DNR with the authority to issue water appropriation permits. So if you're taking more water than is considered to be a amount which is not excessive or not major amount, which is 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year, you have to have a permit. And so that is really useful for putting caps on excessive use, which can sometimes happen in other parts, of, especially in western states. And I mentioned before that we have various priorities for water use so that we can divvy it up in ways which are appropriate, and the DNR has definitely a role in that. So there's two statutes that relate to, I'm going to go through these really quickly, that relate to water law in Minnesota. And these are important because this is the basis for how we are designing our system for making decisions. One of the concepts that we need to ascribe to is that use of water is sustainable to supply the needs of future generations. And if you think about it, that's an incredible far-reaching responsibility that the legislature has written into law. So I think we take advantage of it, and I think we should appreciate it and support it because it's not true in all states, certainly. That water use will not harm ecosystems. That water use will not degrade water quality. So if we are moving water in directions where there has been contamination or moving contaminated water through appropriation process, that's something we need to be concerned about. That use will not reduce water levels beyond reach of the public water supplies and private domestic wells. So an industrial user, it would be not permissible for them to lower levels of a neighboring domestic well or a city well below usable levels. And that groundwater appropriations, and this is actually a really far-thinking, I think also, that groundwater appropriations that have negative impacts to surface waters are subject to applicable surface water appropriation laws. Now, for many years working, and most of my life was working at the Pollution Control Agency, there was a kind of a bright line between surface water world and the groundwater world, and they didn't really meet. And we know, of course, that they are intricately connected. And so for the legislature to put into a law in 2010 that when there is a connection between groundwater and surface water, and we're affecting surface water by groundwater appropriations, we need to apply appropriate surface water protective standards. So these are all tools that we use for our decision-making process. And these are quickly through these water use priorities. The highest level of water use priority is domestic water supply. So it makes sense in a riparian state that if everybody has a right to water, if you live on the land, then you have a right to have water to maintain your needs below levels which are excessive. So that excessive levels would be considered, or high volume uses would be more than 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a year, which is category two. So third down the list is agriculture and agricultural irrigation and processing. So so there we go. We go down the list. Further down the list is power production. Five is consumptive uses in excess of 10,000 gallons a day or 1 million gallons a day a year. And then non-essential uses, car washes, golf courses, and those kinds of things. So if we get down to a point when water becomes limited, we have a system in place to know how to divvy up the water that's available. So what are the limiting factors for groundwater sustainability? And one of the things I think that we are, particularly now that we're looking at the relationship between surface water and groundwater, we're finding that is probably in some ways the most important significant factor in terms of limiting availability. A small amount of groundwater, lowering of groundwater levels, can have a very large effect on surface water features. You know, with a lowering of 5 feet of water during times of low precipitation or drought, that can have drastic effects to a stream. So if you lower that level down to a level where there are no longer fish, it's like taking the oxygen out of a room. If if we said that it was fine that we had oxygen for, you know, 99 days or 364 days out of the year, and the fifth year we didn't have oxygen, that wouldn't work for us. And it's kind of the same thing with streams. So what are we looking at? We're looking at potential impacts to streams, to basins, lakes, and impacts to wetlands and calcareous fens. And the other thing that we look at that's in statute and rule is safe yield. So that's the concept that we don't take more than is rechargeable in a reasonable amount of time. So a couple diagrams in a system that does not have any discharges or removals of water, we see and I put the slide up here for a couple of reasons. One is to show the relationship between surface water and groundwater, and also that sometimes people think that we have an availability problem in Minnesota, and in some places we do, but for the most part, much of Minnesota, we're a pretty water-rich state, and the limiting factor is not drawing the water down so there's not water available. It really is that upper veneer which is causing us to have restrictions because of potential impacts to those surface water features. So in a system where we don't have any withdrawals, we have all the excess water goes to the lowest point and discharges in streams and moves away from whichever area that where the recharge is occurring. So that's what this slide is showing. If we start to put a well in and start pumping that well, what happens is you have a cone of depression of water being drawn into the well and pumped out. And when that happens, you have a incremental drawdown of the water elevation. And if there is pumping at a high enough volume, and or if it's in close enough proximity to a stream, you can start to draw down an amount of water that would normally be going to the stream. Now, for much of the year, this might not be a particular problem, but when is it a problem? It's when, actually, it's the same time of year when we see low flows or base flow conditions in August, maybe into July, August, into September. In that time of the year, not only is it the time when the irrigators would most need to have the water to keep their plants alive, but it's also the time when our systems need the water to maintain their ecological vitality. And with more wells, you can move to the situation where you can actually, if you had enough pumping in an ongoing system, you could actually start to reach a situation where streams go dry for a large portion of the year. And one of the talks this morning showed slides on the Ogallala Aquifer, and this is exactly what's happening in parts of western Kansas. Perennial streams that we used to flow for the majority of the year now are dry for most of the year, except for the spring runoff time. So it can happen. Fortunately, I think in Minnesota that we are getting ahead of the game and we're starting to look at these issues before we reach a crisis situation. But it is time for us to take some actions. Just a bit about, okay, how much can we remove from a stream before we cause it a problem? Now, we have to have allowances for humans to use water. And the question is, what is the balance between the amount of water that's reasonable appropriate for humans to use for various purposes and that ecological impact to the stream? And I think, you know, there's not too much disagreement. If you were to completely draw the streams completely dry, that would be too much water being removed from the stream. That would be too much depletion. Zero amount of water, I think that also isn't reasonable. There's an expectation that that we as humans will use the water to a degree that is balanced. So what this curve shows, if you look on the bottom, it is the proportion of water remaining. So on the far right side, that'd be 0%, zero amount of water remaining. On the far left side on the bottom, it's 1 or 100% of the water remaining. And if you go up on the other axis, it is a percent of maximum habitat. So the assumption is that if there's more habitat, more rich habitat, that indicates a healthier system. So where do you see the curve start to really drop off? It's in the And what our ecologists tell us, that at about 10%, it's hard to see that there's any impacts on streams. And at 20%, we start to see a significant drop-off. So the kind of the sweet zone, or that zone in the middle, is about 15%. So when we're looking at appropriate stream depletion from groundwater extractions during base flow conditions during median August low flows, we're looking at the range of 15%. And a generalized number like this probably makes more sense than a specific number, because there's a number of assumptions that go into this. What we plan on doing over time is, with an adaptive management system, we'll continue to do research and see if these numbers are appropriate, in some cases for particular streams, basins, but for the most part, we're going to be sticking with something in that range. So on the other side, we're talking about water table aquifers and effects on surface water features. We also have to be concerned about confined aquifers. So confined aquifers they're confined, they're under pressure. So the well that you see that has the 100% by it shows a well that has been tapped into a confined aquifer that's under pressure, just like a can of Coke that you've shook up. It's under pressure. If you pop it, the water's going to go up into the air. So in this case, this is a kind of a similar situation. You punch into that confined aquifer, which is under pressure, and the water in that well is going to rise to a level above the level of the aquifer. So this brings us to the concept of safe yield. And safe yield is an appropriation amount that prevents excess depletion of aquifer storage or levels, and also does not degrade the quality of the water in the aquifer. Now, for a confined aquifer, if we were to let that water go to an unconfined state, we would consider that being going past the point of acceptable depletion. So, for example, in California, some places where they're pumping confined aquifers, and we hear stories of subsidence, because you take away that pressure holding the rock up, that's where the water is residing in, you take that away and you have compression. Now, not only have you've reached a situation where it's unconfined, but you probably will never have storage capacity in that aquifer again, even if you did have the recharge. So it does make sense to be careful about these kind of situations. So, and I think Annika's going to have also this slide, but so this shows the way that we're looking at safe yield from confined aquifers. So if you add, sorry, Annika. If we look at where the static level is, what water comes up to and stays there. In a confined situation, unlike a water table aquifer, you don't see much fluctuation in those static levels. So we can look at a static level and say, this is where it is. And then take a look at the 50%, what is half of that amount, theoretically, and then 75% or 25% of remaining head is what we would be measuring. And if through our analysis and monitoring, if we find, or aquifer analyses, if we find that the trends would bring us down below the 25%, if we were at the 50% range, we're on a warning track. When we get down to the 25% of remaining head, that would be a signal that appropriations from that confined aquifer by that user would no longer be appropriate. The other part of in statute, which is in the surface water appropriations, deals with basins. Now, this part of our regulatory responsibility is not, strictly speaking, ecologically based, but it is a standard at which we have to use as a foundational determination of how much water is allowable from basins. And that is, it's the collective annual withdrawals may not exceed 1/2 acre foot per acre of water basin. So 6 inches of water in that basin is a volume that is the maximum allowable to be taken from surface water appropriations. Now, because of the tie between groundwater and surface water, we also apply that same standard when we have groundwater appropriation, which is causing depletion from those basins. So it gets a little more complicated. We have to look at modeling and of some types of analysis to be able to figure this out. But this is the charge that's in front of us. We also have a charge to identify protective elevations. for aquatic vegetation habitat, uses by the public and riparian land owners, and volume and slope of the littoral zone. So taking account into, frankly, this is something that we have not established very many of. We have a responsibility to establish a protective elevation for White Bear Lake, but this is on our list of things that we need to be addressing. So future work. Another limiting factor, particularly when we're filling in a lot of basins with where the easy irrigation locations are gone, we have a statutory responsibility to protect calcareous fens. And calcareous fens, it's pretty strict. They can't be filled, drained, or otherwise degraded, wholly or partially. So we can't touch these things. And it's appropriate because they're really rare features, which... The problem with calcareous fens is, and I'm not an expert, but my understanding is once you degrade them, they're pretty much gone. Once you bring down, what happens with calcareous fens is they rely on a constant upwelling of water, often through some type of a limestone substrate that brings up a kind of a calcified water that's in constant pressure, upwelling pressure. So what it causes, or what their special types of ferns and mosses that grow in these areas, and once they are brought down, even for a relatively short period of time, and you bring an invasive species, you can lose the whole thing. And we have these, where these occur, not surprisingly, is where we have upwelling along the Minnesota River. We see them along the shores of Glacial Lake Agassiz, Beech Ridge areas, and places like that. So when we're talking about concerns, we talk about how do we define concerns? Now, where are those areas of concerns? And you've maybe heard about that. We have a series of three groundwater management areas that have been busily working over the last year, and are starting to come up with their final reports over this. In the next few months. And they are located in the northwest part of the state near Park Rapids, the Spirit River groundwater management area. Bonanza Valley is in central west Minnesota. The major towns of Painesville and Glenwood. And then the North and East Metro, which is a big chunk of the St. Paul side of the river and going to the north. We have also identified other areas that we identify as areas of concern. They're not designated as groundwater management areas, but for various reasons they're in danger of over groundwater extraction and causing various types of problems. And I think I'm not sure this is available on our webpage, but it should be. If it's not, we should put it on there. But you can see some of the green shows the groundwater management areas and other areas where there is intensive irrigation, particularly if there is a limited aquifers that they're drawing from, such as the Pomme de Terre River and the Chippewa River. We see areas along, you can see on the map, the beach ridges along the north shore and of Glacial Lake Agassiz. Those are often where we have some protected fens. The whole southeastern part of Minnesota, which is the near to the surface karst bedrock area, has some special concerns, and in addition, the high growth area of Rochester. So, as we move forward, we'll be looking to give special attention to these areas where we have particular concerns. So, what are our tools for enforcing or trying to move us towards sustainability? And fortunately, I think the DNR really does have some teeth to our, if we use it and use it wisely and don't get too much pushback, I think we are in the path of moving us towards sustainability with the tools that we have. Probably the most important one is that we have water use permit authority and responsibility. So over 10,000 gallons a day or a million gallons a year and if people use above that, they will be operating without a permit, and that there are problems with that we have some means of addressing. And we have a well-established permitting program. We have staff, we have systems in place, we have, for example, a data system called MPARS, which is a Minnesota Permitting, and I forget what the other acronyms are, but it's a way for people to access the information they need to know online, do the reporting online, and provide and are for us to communicate with permit applicants online. So this has been a great addition to our system. We also have a strong technical expertise in our programs. We have monitoring programs, which are probably as good as anywhere in the United States, both surface water and groundwater. We have mapping programs in the state, not only with the Atlas A, which the MGS is in charge of, but the B parts of the Atlas, which is the DNR is responsible for, with the County Atlas Program. That provides us information about where are aquifers and how are they connected. And we have a strong set of staff which are skilled in analysis. So I think we are in a position to do good things. So decision-making criteria needs. So some of these we have and some of these that we are working on. We need standardized threshold criteria. So this is some of the things I mentioned before. How do you define an adverse impact? Until we can define what that adverse impact is, we can't start measuring to see if we are reaching those thresholds, and we don't have a basis for regulatory restrictions. We need to develop and further develop our groundwater depletion determination methodology. So if we have allow an irrigation well, for example, that is in proximity to a trout stream, how do we determine if water, how much water is coming, and there's a, you know, this is it's below ground. People think, if they're not in the business, they think this is an easy thing to do, but it can get really, there's a lot of variables, a lot of complications, and definitely some, it takes, sometimes it takes, I think the people who work in these programs have to have a feel for what they're doing. It's almost like an art, and I've only been at the DNR about 2.5 years, and I'm still learning, but I have a great respect for the professionals that can really have a really good handle on the quantity side of things. The decisions we make need to be quantifiable, and this is going to be important going forward because we want to have a system that will be based on numbers so that we're not arguing over, you know, if something is right or wrong. So we got to have it in the sense that it's if we're arguing about numbers, we're kind of winning the game because that is a way to make non-emotional decisions. We need to do quick decision-making because we have some statutory requirements that we get permits out the door in a very short amount of time. So that you can see these things that what would take years of study, we have to compress into sometimes 30, 150 days, so depending on the situation. So we have that's one of our constraints. Of course, we need to make technically sound and scientifically accurate determinations. And we also, this is a change for the DNR from the way we operate in the past, is we need to make cumulative decisions. So because we know that if you pump a well, even if it doesn't have a direct impact to a stream, there's going to be a lag effect. So we need to take that into account in addition to all the other wells that might be affecting the feature which we are concerned about. Where does that lead us? There's something that we need to be moving towards and that we're making a commitment to is we are committed at the DNR to moving forward, and this is going to take some time. So this is, you know, where I've given some, you know, people, when I'm talking about this, they say, make sure everybody knows this is not going to happen overnight. We'd rather do it right than do it fast. But over the next few years, we are going to be developing groundwater models for some of our all of our groundwater management areas and some of our areas of concern that could benefit from them. When we think about models, we kind of think about a tiered approach. And are models needed everywhere? Well, no, they're not. If you have an isolated irrigator, for example, that is an area where there is no other irrigation, not close to any protected features, we don't need to have a full-blown groundwater model. In fact, that'd be foolish. It'd be a waste of time. But on the highest level, on a watershed scale, we look at identifying where are our problems areas. And that would be, think about that as a watershed scale mass balance. So it helps identify where our area of concerns are. And this could be as basic as how much water is being pumped relative to stream flow in the vicinity. And so you could get more elaborate than that, but basically, what is the balance? What is the likelihood of having areas of concern that are going to get us into water use problems? A second layer down is kind of the way we are approaching our work now in decision making, and that is with simple analytical models. They're not full of models. I think time is going quickly, so I'm going to kind of start to move this along. This is where we have a few appropriators, homogeneous conditions, and non-complicated boundary conditions. So where we are moving towards is for those areas of concern, complete full numerical groundwater models. And where we see the vision of this going is we want to be able to simulate complex system responses to those protected features. We need to be able to calculate both individual, because we need to have one number for each permit of how much water they can have, but have that in relationship to the cumulative use around them. It's going to be really important for us to have some effective planning and options analysis tools. So, you know, maybe in some areas, land into alfalfa and somebody else puts in the corn. So if we can stimulate innovation and conservation, we can make better use of our water. So what DNR will be doing is setting those boundary conditions, what are those thresholds, and then allowing innovation to go on within those boundaries. And, you know, I'm going to quickly go through some of these things. We need some of the things that we're talking about today. What would have to go into a model? Well, we need to have a construct of what is the nature of the hydrogeologic framework. That includes where are aquifers, why are they connected, and if they're not, then we don't have to worry about them. But if they are, then we need to know that. We need to know stream flow, gauging, and we have a great gauging station. But the USGS is also working on synthetic hydrographs, so we can identify between areas where we have gauging, have a fair estimate of what that stream flow is, because we have to compare the stream flow to the depletion to see if we are within allowable threshold standards. Groundwater monitoring through our observation well network and tied to other observation well networks in the state to tell us what we're doing in terms of water levels. Aquifer hydrologic properties, hydraulic properties, that would be primarily, we're talking about various things, but storativity and transitivity, so that we can use that information to know what in the calculation of depletions in the model, then those are, I guess you call them, essential properties. We have a climatology, precipitation, evapotranspiration system. We have, we'll be enhancing that, but that's an important part of the model. And also recharge, that we need some estimates, which I think is fortunate that we have some of the things going on in our state right now. So buzzing things really quickly, those things that I just mentioned, here's where we're doing the measurement to find out, you know, where are we at and what are the data sets that we need. We have atlases being constructed, either have constructed or are being constructed in a good share of the state, and that's going to continue as we move forward and even better coverage. And this is an example of what is produced in the Part B. I'm not going to talk about this. This is Chisago County that John Barry has been producing. But these cross-sections that we produce are essential for understanding what the nature of our connectivity is. So this all ties into understanding and making appropriation decisions. An important piece of work that we have staff working on, Greg Brick and Jeff Green have been working on a state spring inventory. Where are the springs in the state, statewide? And you can see that they're not just in the southeast. They are, as we're doing our phase one on this, that we have indications that they're almost in every county of the state. Important work that Roberta Adams is working on is doing edge mapping. We have where we have county atlases, they're done at different times by different people, and sometimes it's like a fault has gone between there. They don't match. So we're going through an edging process so that we can connect them up from between county lines or whichever part of of the Atlas was produced. I mentioned a little bit of the aquifer analysis program. We have a program going where we are conducting aquifer tests and doing the analyses so that we can collect the, and together with this, with MDH, we are putting together a shared interagency aquifer test database, so we have easy access to all of this information. And we have tests going on now, aquifer test information. We're doing pump tests down in Dakota County, and we'll be going to other locations also. I'm not going to talk about the data, but there's a major data integration effort going on between the agencies, both time series and discrete series. What we want to have is access to all the data that's relevant in the hydrology world. And that's going to be not only groundwater, surface water, climatology, and other analyzed information. And as you mentioned again, we have an observation well network, which has we have about 1,000 wells and growing, and as we move forward, we're going to be placing those not only in ambient areas but in locations that will help us give us sentinel locations of to make sure that we're making good decisions. And we have the stream gauging network, which is kind of the heart and soul of how we can make decisions, because if we don't know what the flow is, particularly at times of the year when we need to understand it, we're not able to make our stream depletion calculations about how much water is allowable. And the water recharge, I won't talk about that because Andrew and Eric produced something that is going to be very useful for us. So all of the shared information that we're using is going to be used for our determination going forward for making more sustainable decisions for water quantity in Minnesota. And I think I'm out of time, so thank you.